The Babylon Podcast was our last best hope for B5 fans. A self-contained show, 1 hour long, located on an RSS feed. A place for interviews and episode discussions for a whole bunch of humans and aliens. A shining beacon in cyberspace, all alone on the web. It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, the year the Lost Tales came upon us all. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2007. The name of the show is The Babylon Podcast.
Welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
Hey there, it's Jeffrey Willard calling from what most Americans consider to be the greatest jump gate running from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Yes, it's the Highway 10, US 10, going from coast to coast. Jump gate, perhaps. I wouldn't call it hyperspace speeds, though. No, no. So here we are in Culver City, quickly approaching West LA, about to get onto the 405, which is a secret code for, no, you're not going anywhere.
I was going to say, how many hours now have you been on the road trying to get home?
Last February 24th is when I left, and they should allow drinking while you drive.
Well, but you're not really driving, so it should be okay.
Yeah, there you go. Parking.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not cold, and it's not snowing, and that's a good thing.
Yes, it is. Yes, indeed. Spring is on its way. You can feel it in the air.
So can you tell us what you were working on?
I am producing a series for the HGTV network called Over Your Head.
Over Your Head.
Okay, keep your applause to yourself.
I'm trying to figure out what that's about based on the title, and I'm coming up with a blank.
Roof.
Well, you know, Stargate, it's not like that. You know Doctor Who?
Yeah.
Not like that. Star Trek, the original series? No, not like that. It's not like any of those.
Okay, Jeffrey, I'll bail you out. I've seen the series. I actually like it, so.
Wow.
It's about roofing.
Okay, so now our audience is up by 50%.
So it's called Over Your Heads, but it's not about roofing?
No.
No, that was very clever, though. That would have been smart. That's good. You should be in programming. That's a great idea.
I'd like to be. I'm working on it.
Careful what you wish for. This is a fun series where we find homeowners that get themselves into projects that they just wind up over their head.
I see.
Home improvement hell.
Expert shows up to help them get out of their jam.
Oh.
Yeah, so I watch this show and laugh at the stupid people.
So this is
basically
like home improvement projects gone bad, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like they walk in and it's like, oh my God, what did you do?
Oh, that's kind of cool.
So you can imagine some of the inherent difficulties in that project. It's not like, oh, you want to make over your room? Fine, we'll take everything out and put in all nice new stuff. No. It's like, what were you thinking
when
you started this project?
I do this for my day job and get paid.
I'm just annoyed because I have projects way worse than this at my own house. I can't figure out what I'm spending my time doing this for other people.
Do I hear next week's production? This week we're at the Willard House.
Yeah. Tune in next week when Jeffrey, and then tune in the following week when Jeffrey.
All right. Just mysteriously swap the addresses on the sheet.
What's on the slate for tonight, kids? What do we got going on?
We are deep geeking on Hunter Prey.
Hunter Prey. That's the one where there's a lot with Kosh and Sheridan, right?
There is, yes.
You see? Got to get up pretty early. You're going to get one past me there, Tim Callender.
I'm having a deja vu moment.
I do have a question for you, because this was, as we were discussing...
That's episode 213, right?
Yes.
We see
your
more
knowledge
Kosh
is astounding.
Well, you know, he's...
Kosh summoned Sheridan, right?
Yes. He did.
Okay, good. Yes, okay, I just want to make sure.
Yeah, Sheridan's wearing a breather mask, okay?
Yes, yes.
Yes, and Kosh is just in his encounter suit. So was there a reason Slaytner had to wear a breather mask in your presence?
I smelled really bad. It was B.O. They still have B.O. in the future.
I imagine running around in that encounter suit doesn't do a whole lot for freshness either.
And you know what? That's a great trivia question. I seem to recall that Kosh's, the Vorlon atmosphere had to be something like nitrogen and methane or something like that. Or I remember them making some kind of explanation about like two really, really bad gases that made up the ambassadorial suite there. And everybody had to have... some kind of protection. I think mostly it was to keep the Vorlon beer cold, but I don't know what, you know.
Well, no, it does have that sort of, you know, the billowing freezer look going on as well. Now, I'm curious, though, because there were a significant number of shots of Kosh, and so the script comes along, and you look at that, and you think about the, 90 pounds of fiberglass you got to wear on your shoulders. I mean, do you just look at all those scenes and go, oh, my God, what are they thinking?
No, I was thinking about the paycheck. No, honestly, it's about the paycheck. It was a good thing every time Kosh was in a script. That was a good thing.
Gotcha. It's always about the money, you Hollywood types, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I think I've talked about this before, but that was a liquid nitrogen that we would spray. It was very, very cold, and it was often problematic. So the camera crew that would squeeze into that little Kosh office there would have to have their winter coats on. Sometimes the liquid nitrogen was so cold that it would cause things that it landed on to explode, pieces of plastic and wood would crack and pop. I remember the paint on the floor would become so brittle it would literally shatter and burst. You know, it was not a fun place to. And it would, excuse me, it would land on the encounter suit and sounded like I was in a hailstorm. So it was not. It was an experience for sure.
I got nothing.
And I was going to say that you suffered all gladly for your art, but you've already just burst that bubble. So,
yeah, no, it's the worst thing about it is my poor mom could never tell that was really me. I go, no, that's me. And she's like, why? Why is that you? It doesn't even look like you. Couldn't you get on one of those soap operas when I can see you all the time?
As the Vorlon turns.
All my Vorlons?
Something like that. Yeah.
Stop.
And then the problem, though, is that Jeffrey would be nominated for an Emmy 16 times and never win.
Yeah. They call me Lucci.
Lucci, you got some splaining to do.
Oh.
Exactly. Wait. Boy, I was afraid he was going to run that way.
Get us out of here, Summer.
Yeah.
We are going to cut short this pun fest and be right back after the break with some deep geeking on Hunter Prey, the episode Jeff doesn't remember.
You should listen to Victor Katyal with a typical PC user podcast. It's like the coolest podcast ever. Victor can help with your computer problems. He has like tons of skills. Backup skills, hacker skills, programming skills, ninja attack skills. So I listen to him whenever I can get on the frickin' computer. Gosh!
Don't be jealous that I've been chatting online with babes all day.
So listen to Victor, and all your wildest dreams will come true at www.typicalpcuser.com.
Digging down to the obscurest facts in fandom, this is Deep Geeking.
And we are back with tonight's Deep Geeking on the episode Hunter Prey.
Yes, in which a crucial piece of evidence regarding Clark's involvement in Santiago's assassination comes to the station, and our heroes find themselves between a rock and a hard place.
Almost literally.
Yes. let me start off. One of the observations I had when I rewatched this episode today for our Deep Geeking is how much stuff is packed into this show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not so much in terms of, not like crucial information. It's not like Coming of Shadows. That's so weighty. You know, that one just, you know, drips with importance and weight. But this one, it's not as action-packed as it gets to a certain extent, okay? I mean, it's the cat-and-mouse game. It's the chase. Dr. Jacobs, who was the former physician to then-Vice President Clark, is on the run with information that shows that Clark knew that Earth Force One was going to be destroyed. Of course, we don't know that until halfway through the episode. What we're told is by Agent Cranston of Earth Special Intelligence is that Dr. Jacobs is on the run with information that could tear the Earth Alliance apart. And so Captain Sheridan is given orders to apprehend Dr. Jacobs and, if necessary, use deadly force to stop him. It's only about halfway through. Well, I wouldn't say halfway through. Again, that's one of those things. It's so full of stuff. Maybe a good quarter of the way, third of the way through. Mm-hmm. An agent from General Haig shows up to tell Captain Sheridan that, yes, Dr. Jacobs is on the run. Yes, he has crucial information, but it's information that shows that Clark knew that Earth Force One was going to be destroyed, and he faked an illness and got off before it went to Io. And, of course, at this point in time, station security is on the job looking frantically for Dr. Jacobs, and now Captain Sheridan finds himself in the sticky position of having to go around his own people.
Mm-hmm. I like the argument between him and what's her name?
I don't know that she had the name.
I don't know. Did they mention her name? Anyway, between the two of them, that could have been boiled down to, you couldn't have called me yesterday about this.
Yes. Yes. Although I'll have to say this, that didn't bother me too much.
It didn't bother me. I just thought it was funny because you had this long conversation and he has this look on his face like, no matter which side I'm on, good guys or bad guys, there's always bureaucracy in the way.
Yeah. Well, I love the toward the end of that first conversation where she tells Sheridan, find Jacobs, get what he knows. Let's get him away from Cranston's people. Get him off the station alive. And Sharon is like, fine, you want mail on that? You know, she gives him the laundry list. And her attitude about it is really kind of, here's the situation. It's in your lap now, Captain. You know, don't know how you're going to do it, but we expect results.
We expect you to pull a spare miracle out of your back pocket before lunch. Get back to us on that.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. Exactly. We also find ourselves with a brief reference to infection, about the only thing that is of advantage to infection. is that Garibaldi goes to Franklin, who learned at Harvard from Dr. Jacobs.
Mm-hmm.
And when given the information that Dr. Jacobs is on the run, Franklin is incensed. So Dr. Jacobs would never sell out Earth. Are you kidding? There's been a mistake. And I love Garibaldi's response. Well, last time you vouched for a doctor friend, there was, you know, half a dozen bodies dead on the floor, half the station was trashed, and the car and war machine was burning through decks.
And the look on Franklin's face, he doesn't really say much about it, but the look on his face is like, oh, you were keeping count of all that, huh?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, one of the things that I liked in that exchange is the different worldviews. Franklin's like, would you get your head up out of the barracks? So, yeah, and Garibaldi, yeah, sure, if people start shooting at me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? What a wonderful world you live in. Yeah, well, the rent's cheap, the pay's okay, and I can set my own hours. but that's also one of those instances where the bond between those two characters starts growing stronger. And especially, I really liked the exchange in Down Below when they've gone undercover, Franklin and Garibaldi, to look for Jacobs. And Garibaldi convinces Franklin to just take a break and sit down, have something to eat, and they start talking about, you know, reminiscing. And Garibaldi asks him, well, how do you know Jacobs a long time? Yeah, knew him when we were young, and the future was bright, and they get, you know, very introspective. And I like the whole Franklin speech about the future being like the toys that you saw on the vids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And once it was here, it's never quite lived up to what you expected. And you're so disappointed, you put it in the closet, and you never play with it again. And I found that very poignant. And I think, in a broader sense, I think you can see some of that disillusionment in society today. But that's a conversation for another time.
We'll have to have a detailed technical conversation, because I know there's a there's a special about the technology that was inspired by all the people who watched Star Trek as a kid. I want to do a special in another 10 years of the technology that may have been inspired by people who watched Babylon 5 when they were young.
Our friend Cameron McDonald from Down Under sent a link to an article from a computer magazine talking about
InfoWorld,
yes. And in it, at the very end of the little article, it said, perhaps the data crystals from Babylon 5 are not too far away after all.
Yeah, that was way cool.
But we digress.
Yes, but I liked at the beginning of that where you've got Franklin commenting on how he feels less safe now that Garibaldi is dressed like a 1930s PI.
Yes.
The hat makes the outfit, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Number one, I don't go down there that often. Number two, when they see me, they see the badge. Number three, I have a very good disguise. let's see. Let's backtrack a little bit. We do see Jacobs on the station. He is on the run. I liked the scene where he's in the little bazaar there and Down Below looking for an identicard. And his contact there, the little shopkeeper, it's like, well, yeah, and it's going to cost you. And when Jacob says, well, I'll pay whatever you want, the guy basically says, okay, never mind. You want it too much. You're in too deep trouble. And I like that because that was kind of playing against cliche.
Mm-hmm.
You know, number one, Jacobs was not, he was like a doctor who was a staff doctor to Earthdome. You know, he's on the run. He's got just enough smarts to stay ahead of the game, but he's not smart enough to play the game, if you follow what I mean.
Yeah.
In other words, he doesn't know to go and dicker with the guy and all the rest and be, you know, just some guy. You know, he's that desperate. Whatever it's going to take. Okay. You know, and then the shopkeeper, again, against sort of convention, rather than taking him for all his money, says, "Nope, nope, I don't want to touch you because you are obviously too hot." I love that. He says, "No, no, no, is it the money? That's not the money. You don't want it too badly," which means, you know, you're in very deep trouble. No, you're either with station security or you're in trouble with some very, very bad people.
Either way, I don't want any of it. I'm out of here. Bye.
Yeah, right. And he closes up shop. I mean, it isn't like, you know, shoes him off. He shuts down completely. Love that bit. Then, of course, Jacobs gets picked up by a thug. Oh, I wouldn't say a thug. What's the word I'm looking for?
An opportunist.
There you go. That's an excellent, excellent adjective. Yes, he's picked up. He kind of is lurking about. A guy named Max, big hulking guy, realizes that Jacobs doesn't belong in down below. And apprehends him, shall we say, and then discovers, yeah, he is. He's up. He's got a data crystal. He's got a pocket watch that could fetch some bucks. And since he's obviously with some high-ranking people, he says either, you know, somebody will pay a lot for what's on the data crystal or somebody will pay a lot for Dr. Jacobs. And he goes and contacts Agent Cranston. One of the things I liked about this was with Max, he looks at the data crystal. What's it? What is it? Names, numbers, account numbers, mm-hmm. And that's the extent of it. I mean, he doesn't think any bigger than that.
Yeah, and that Max was distracting to me.
Really?
Yes. Max was Max is not the character. But the fact that I'm watching this person, Richard Mull, trying to sneer, and all I'm seeing is Bull from Night Court.
Okay, you know what? I didn't even make the connection. The actor's name meant nothing to me, and I was never big enough. I mean, now that you say it, I see it.
Yeah.
But
I just see, you know, big guy, not so bright, just going through his day. And I couldn't get the image of Bull out of my head while watching this episode. This was the first time around when I'm watching him. I'm going, why'd they get him?
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
Yep. But, yeah, this episode had few weak spots for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just his portrayal of that character was the weakest spot. Everything else was, we were spoon-fed lots and lots of little tidbits, and half of them we didn't realize how important they were until much later.
Yeah. Right. The weakest link for me in this episode actually is where the B story gets tied into it. And let's take a moment to talk about that, and then mm-hmm. we'll work our way toward that weak link. And in this one, the episode starts off with Garibaldi looking for Sheridan and Ivanova, only to be told by Corwin that they're down in Docking Bay 13. So nobody goes down there. That's because that's where Ambassador Kosh's ship is docked. Now, one thing that I noticed this time around is that I think the Vorlon ship exuded a Shatner acting zone. This thing, the last maintenance crew that was down here, they wouldn't come back. Back away slowly. Just a lot of broken lines, a lot of broken mm-hmm. sentences. But that I'm just being silly. I liked them going down and looking at the ship, even though the CG, even at the time, seemed a little weak. I think they were really pushing that one to the max. It was kind of creepy. And the thing that came out that was extruded out of the ship and, I don't know, scanned Sheridan's heart or something. You know, what was that all about? And of course, as they leave, there's Kosh comes gliding out from behind the crates, and the ship says something. And Kosh nods and glides away again.
And somewhere I have enough instances of the Vorlon alphabet. I want to know, what did anybody actually ever decipher what the ship was telling him?
You know, on a related note, in the episode escapes me now, after interludes and examinations, when Sheridan's taking a walk on the end of the cargo arm there,
mm-hmm.
and the Vorlon ship pops up, and it has writing on it.
Yeah.
In the Lurker's Guide, JMS replies, number one, that he doesn't know enough Vorlon to be able to translate it. But he thinks it says aloha.
Hmm. Now, where would a Vorlon ship learn aloha?
Well, obviously from Minbar, because if you recall Vir Koto's shirt he wears in...
Oh, that's right.
Comes back, and it's got Minbari writing on it, and that says aloha in Minbari. So I'm detecting a theme here.
JMS really, really, really liked Hawaii.
Something, I don't know. Or they grabbed a hold of one joke and they're beating the crap out of it. So anyways, Sheridan decides to make learning about Kosh a personal project. And the mysterious Vorlon does his best to encourage this. You know, you recall the scene where Sheridan's walking down the empty hallway, and he's standing at the lift door, and all of a sudden he gets that kind of sense like somebody's watching, and he whips around, and there's Kosh gliding away. And Sheridan's great, because he's just trying to be, you know, Mr. Representative from Earth. Well, Ambassador, I was hoping we could get together maybe later this afternoon. You know, it's like, I don't know if, you know, almost the tone of, like, I don't know what you would have for tea, but let's have tea. And, you know, Kosh seems to be willing. And when Sheridan finally does, well, actually, when Kosh summons him, which is unheard of, there's that cryptic exchange. Can you tell me about you? Can you tell me about you? And when Sheridan just kind of gives sort of pat answers, Kosh says, nope, you don't understand. Go. And Sheridan, this I think is an interesting hint of things to come, because rather than going or being kind of, you know, put off, he's more put off. You know, he doesn't feel like he's, what's the word I want? He is not afraid of the thing that everybody else seems to be afraid of. In other words, the Vorlons are mysterious, the Vorlons are creepy, and, you know, they're ways past the understanding of mere mortal men, so we shouldn't mess with them. Sheridan is like, well, what do you want? You summoned me here, and you're going to kick me out? It's like, what do you want? And 11, Kosh was wrong. Never ask that question. And Sheridan's response, well, at least I got a response.
Yep. I think maybe Kosh was looking for that type of reaction, waiting for someone to assert themselves against him instead of being deferential or fearful. And that was the moment when he said, okay, this is someone I can teach.
Yes. Until you're ready. Ready for what? To fight legends. You creepy.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of foreshadowing there. Now, like I said, all that stuff was neat stuff. This is one of the reasons I feel this episode, like I said at the beginning, is packed. We've got the plot with the frantic search for Dr. Jacobs. We've got, in the midst of it, Sheridan trying to learn about Kosh. And I love the scene. He's talking with Ivanova as they're trying, you know, things are starting to heat up and they're trying to find a way out. And Sheridan gets a call and says, well, one of the ambassadors wants to speak to you. And he's like, oh, I can't wait. And as well, it's Ambassador Kosh. And that just brings everything to a screeching halt. And Ivanova, she's like, the 2 years I've been here, he's never asked for anybody. And that's when they have the meeting. Now, here's where I think the weak spot is.
Mm-hmm.
When Franklin and Garibaldi finally find Jacobs. And it's a bit of a coincidence they're in front of the same seller who's got Jacob's pocket watch. But you know what? I'll give you the coincidence. They've rescued Jacobs. He's telling Sheridan everything he knows. But they realize that they can't get him off the station because Cranston's people are about to hook into the internal station sensors, and they'll be able to find Jacobs just like that. And Sheridan has a plan. And as we find out later on, basically they put Jacobs into a induced coma and then put him in Kosh's ship and then send the ship off the station. And this is the weak part for me. You've just established a relationship with an ambassador, a being who seems to be above establishing relationships. And one of the first things you're going to do is ask him to smuggle a fugitive away. At the very least, I would love to have seen that exchange, because that, I think, would have been telling as well with that relationship.
Yeah.
But as it was just kind of, it was a little hard to swallow that after all this, you know that, like I said, the exchange prior, you know, you and I both agree Sheridan's got to push to get something out of Kosh, and that's Kosh's cue that this guy's got more moxie than everybody else does, so he's somebody to watch. But it just seems weird that the first thing he would do would grant him the favor of letting a human on board a ship, on board his ship. You know, it just doesn't quite ring true for me.
I understand needing to get that help. Excuse me. But I don't understand. I don't know. Maybe Kosh saw something different. Maybe. Why would he just say, oh, you want me to help you hide a fugitive? Sure.
Right.
Now, for me, the weak part was the, hey, you are able to turn the sensors inward and scan inside. Do it again.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that was too easy. That was the, yeah. To use your sentiments from previous things, that was a trick out of the Star Trek bag.
Yeah. But having said that, like I said, I think those are minor quibbles. The actor who played Dr. Jacobs, I think, did a great job. You know, he had that kind of air of desperation, but he also looked like somebody who has been working at the very highest levels of government.
For way too long.
Yes. Right. I loved the scene between Max and Garibaldi at the very end. In a sense, it's reminiscent of the scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark where Indy's faced off with the guy with the giant sword.
Really?
It wasn't like it was going to be this big climatic knockdown, drag him out. There's Garibaldi. He's been stabbed in his arm by Max's associate. And Max gives him the bravado. You know, says, come on, Max. You got to give me the day of the crystal. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. And Carol just starts pulls out his PPG and starts shooting. So I've had a very bad day. And basically frames Max with a number of shots and just says, you know, I'm cranky, so give me what I want.
Before I get surly.
Yes, right. I like that because it wasn't like you had to beat Max into submission. You just basically needed to be a badder ass than him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Garibaldi's that guy, and I thought that worked. I like that.
So yeah, I liked that they didn't drag that out longer than they had to. So just go in there, show that you've got more muscle than him, and walk away right. With the stuff.
One of the other things that I liked about this is that, I mean, it's almost obvious to say that it moves the plot forward, but it does. There's no ambiguity in the sense that, other than, you know, was Jacob's on the run because he had stolen information, or is he on the run because he was trying to get away from the government? You know, that was ambiguity. Wasn't played out too long, and I like that. But this, it gets back to the whole plot of where Clark's involvement was with Santiago. So we're working with things that have already been established in the universe, and we're actually answering questions. And I like that too.
And we see a lot of little tiny hints here and there about stuff that comes around later. We see, I don't know, I guess the interaction with Sheridan and the Hague's liaison. You know, it's like, you're expecting me to, you know, work a miracle here. And she's like, yes, we are. You know, so you see him set up to do the impossible. And he does it repeatedly, especially after they break away from Earth. We see Dr. Jacobs with the stems. And we see that later on affect Dr. Franklin. There's also, literally is a blink and you miss it kind of thing. When Sheridan notices the red ribbon on the stairwell.
Yes.
Did you notice that the guy who walked by him and Garibaldi up the stairs they just came down?
I noticed that they passed a guy, but go ahead. I think I know where you're going with this.
Well, he's dressed like a ranger, and I think you would have missed it if you didn't see Garibaldi turn around and actually look at the guy. So we have you know, more ranger stuff going on that Garibaldi's aware of and Sheridan's not.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. I upon rewatching Soulmates, the scene where in the Zocalo, and I can't remember if it's the one where Mariel or Stoner is in front of Mr. Ohm.
Mr. Ohm.
Sorry. But if you look back there, it's one of those things, too, like the gentleman on the stairs. I think I caught a ranger in there. I think it was Minbari.
Mm.
So, yeah. Yeah, I can't remember which one of those scenes, and it's one of those things that is there for 3 seconds. But I think there's a ranger there. So, yes, you're right. Once again, we're getting the clues. If you know to look for them, there they are. The figures are moving quietly throughout Babylon 5 and the galaxy. And I liked that little exchange coming off the stairs where Sheridan notices the little red ribbon. And all of a sudden he's like, you know what? I just thought of something I needed to do. And there's Garibaldi giving him the look.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we've noted before, Garibaldi's suspicious nature, and that one just does not escape his notice. But he's not going to say anything to the captain.
Now, is this event another secret, another conspiracy that Sheridan collects? Or do we just not even bother with that anymore since now he's in the middle of one?
I think we don't bother with it because now he's in the middle of one. I think at going forward, he is going to, although we haven't seen but so much of his predilection for conspiracies, one has to think that what he has learned about conspiracies and collecting them, he now has to put into play to enact one. That's one of his frustrations, talking with Hague's liaison, is that somehow he's got to keep it quiet. And you know what? I think he almost spills the beans. At the very end, in CNC, as they're getting ready to flip on the internal sensors, and Kosh's ship is leaving, and Cranston is kind of going toe-to-toe with Sheridan. I think Cranston knows something's afoot. Because he does say, he says something to the effect of, scan the ship. I said, well, that's an ambassadorial ship. I said, he won't notice. So scan it, unless there's something to hide. And Sheridan gets a smug look on, like, I'll see you're bluffing Razia, see you're calling Razia. And it's like, okay, go ahead and scan the ship. And it detects the one life form. Although that's a little inconsistent with, I don't know. No, never mind. I'll take that back. I was going to say at the beginning of the episode, Ivanova mentions that they had tried to scan Kasha's ship as much as they could get away with and couldn't really get any further than the skin. But Cranston wouldn't know that, so that's fine.
Mm-hmm. But we also know Kosh wasn't really on the ship. His ship was just giving back a reading that there's a Vorlon on board. There's a non-human on board.
Right. So anyways, but Sheridan's response to all that, as it's going on and the sensors come online and there's no evidence of Jacobs on the station, then Sheridan is all goodness and sunshine. Now that you finished tearing my station upside down, we've established that Jacobs is not here. Let's do everything we can to cooperate to a fullest extent so that you can leave soon. Some of that might just be natural antipathy between, a soldier of the ranks, as it were, and an intelligence guy, but as Ivanova says, you enjoyed that.
And, of course, he has to deny. Always deny.
Of course. Yeah. So
do you have any overall thoughts for this show and the arc?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I think that it while may not be one of those, PPG bolts between the eyes kinds of shows, I think it does a great job of moving the overall story forward. I think it has some great character moments. Excellent pacing. And it's a solid show. It bears rewatching and holds up very well over repeated watchings.
That's it.
Okay. How about you? Where do you put it?
No, I was waiting for you to talk for another 5 minutes about that.
I tricked you.
Got you. You got me. No, I like how, again, you see little tidbits of things. Things that seem like they're throwaway in the episode that later rise up as necessary information. And that sort of plotting aforethought, I love. And that's why the series is so much fun to rewatch and rewatch, because each time you watch it, you go, oh, okay. You see things, even if they're not intentional, which I'm hoping they are, they refer to future events. Or even past ones. So, I don't know. I guess I like the way that all links together. Like I said, the only drawback for me for this episode was Max's character. How necessary was that? I don't know. It just threw me off.
Well, I think the character was necessary. I think having that third element in there of persons looking for Jacobs and getting a hold of Jacobs, I think that was important to the pacing of the story.
But how did he know how to get a hold of Cranston?
I'm sure Cranston's... I will bet that he probably just kind of followed the trail. In other words, all of a sudden, security is everywhere. And they didn't make any bones about it. There's the scene where they come close to natting Jacobs, where Zach and another security guy are scanning lurkers and kind of flipping around, and Garibaldi mentions later on to Franklin that my people have already been through here, so everyone's real skittish. So yeah, I think security's been out in full force. So that's a tip off to anybody who's savvy enough, and Max has got to be savvy enough to pay attention to that kind of stuff. So then maybe ask a few questions. You know, and maybe he's got some contacts somewhere who might have overheard something.
I could see
him. I don't know. You know,
I never gave it that much thought.
They never bothered me. And it could be that Cranston's people even put out the call and said, you know, we're looking for this guy. Have you seen him? I don't know. Honestly, Summer never gave it much thought. It made sense to me, and on to the next thing.
Okay, fine. I just, you know, you would see him maybe contacting somebody low-level security, because you see security people walking around looking for somebody. You make that connection. How do you know to contact a federal agent who just happened to come in that day looking for somebody?
Yeah, I mean, maybe if logically, if you want to look at it logically, he would have gotten a hold of security, said, you know what, you guys are looking for somebody. I think I've got your guy.
Mm-hmm. Because the security people are there
to
run down.
In charge,
yeah,
right?
They're there to run down the false leads, of which they're probably getting a lot.
Well, Sheridan even points that out. He says, mm-hmm. you know, if you offer that you're looking for something or someone, you'll get 10 offers. We'll try to scam you out of the money. Yeah, I don't know. I guess, you know, maybe that's another weak link in there. But for me, every time watching the episode, I get so caught up in what's going on that it goes past me. So.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
I hear what you're saying. I don't have
yeah.
a good explanation.
Like I said, it's one minor, you know, back of the brain nit about a pretty good episode. So
yeah.
So that will wrap up our discussion of Hunter Prey. And we'll be right back after the break with some listener feedback or other stuff.
Grasshopper, you have learned much in your training. However, to achieve ultimate geekness, you must pass one final test. You must snatch this chip from my hand, Grasshopper. I wasn't looking. You must snatch this chip from my hand. Once again, you must snatch this chip from my hand. You must snatch this chip. Enough!
Learn to be a true master. Visit GeekFooActionGrip.com.
And we are back with our abbreviated listener feedback section. We have some emails to get through this time around, don't we?
Yes, we do. And you might have spoken too early.
Uh-oh.
So no, yeah, and I'll save that one for the last. But let's go through a couple here. This comes from Jefferson in Bedfordshire, UK. Says, just thought I'd drop in and say we do exist. That's for you, Jeffrey, who is wondering where all our UK listeners were. Jefferson goes on to say, I'm an avid listener to your show. I've been rewatching B5 for years. More recently, I've started to lose my sight, so now I sit and listen to them, which is interesting, as I think I pick up things in a different way now. So keep up the good work, and I'll keep listening. Not a problem, Jefferson. Happy to do it. I would say there was a period in time where I had managed to wire my VCR in through the stereo into the tape deck, and I recorded a handful of episodes to cassette to listen to on my commute, which was roughly about 30 minutes, so it wasn't quite a full episode, but It was surprising how well they would hold up when they were audio only.
And
I got nothing. There you go. Tim's out there on a limb by himself.
I got nothing. Why
would I do that?
Yeah.
Because
for the commute.
Yeah, for driving to work.
Because it was too hard to get the TV in the front seat of the car. That's
but
why.
It's such. Right. I would have less enjoyment hearing the show without some of the visuals. I mean, the space battle scenes where it's all music and laser blasts. Pew, 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 pew. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I had long Twilight Struggle. That
is that what it sounded like to you? Pew, 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 pew?
No, pew. It's a harder consonant. It's a
wow.
P as opposed to a B. Well, you know what? You don't know what you're missing, and I'm not going to try to convert the unwashed, so let's just go to the next one.
Okay.
I just thought there was going to be a punchline there. You got to the end of the story.
That was no punchline. Yeah, you're so disappointed. No, there's no punchline. It made for good listening, surprisingly. So there.
Uh-huh.
Jefferson, I understand where you're coming from, okay? I can't vouch for the rest of these yahoos. All right, here we go. This is from Laz. Anyway, he says, I just wanted to comment on Gropos. I always had a few problems with this episode, the minor one being Garibaldi's attitude towards sleeping with Dodger. B5 always seemed to be more adult for its time in accepting things like, gasp, people having sex outside marriage. And Garibaldi was always a fairly down-to-earth character who accepts the realities of situations. It seemed to be out of character and the heavy hand of some moralizing editor somewhere that made him deliver a toe-curling speech to Dodger about how he was saving himself for special with someone. He would have either slept with Dodger or given her a brush off long before she got to his bedroom. Did he think he was just going to show her his third favorite thing in the universe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I disagree with most all of that, but... Summer, what would your response be to Laz?
I don't know. I mean, we've seen other characters have sex, so it's not like it was a big deal.
Right.
So maybe it was just he was just trying to exaggerate Garibaldi's, you know, emotional conflict. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't have any problem with that at all. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I don't think Summer can actually blame Garibaldi. I think she would jump in bed with Dodger, too.
I'm not as attracted to redheads as you are.
Pew, 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 pew.
Now, would Dodger be able to coax Kosh out of the encounter suit?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Are you kidding? Chicks in uniforms? Hello? Wake up.
And then chicks out of uniform.
Oh, even better.
Okay, here is another comment. This comes from Greg Smith. It says, I wanted to clear up some confusion you had about the books. And he was talking about the novelizations. The ones that you need are To Dream in the City of Sorrows by Catherine M. Drennan, JMS wife, I believe. The Shadow Within by Gene Cavellos, billed on republishing as a prequel to the Technomage trilogy, which it sort of is, in that it sets up exactly how Anna and Morden come to be what we see them as at the beginning of the trilogy, and the 5 season-by-season guides by Jane Killick. All are highly recommended, and all are currently available at Amazon.com for pretty cheap. I think I might have mentioned To Dream of the City of Sorrows was written by Gene Cavellos at a previous podcast I was mistaken. But Summer, I know you've had high praise for the season guides.
Yeah, the season guides by Jane Killick are, I actually bring them with me doing the show to flip through for reference, or actually flip through before. Each of them has, I don't know, 7 pages or so of color photographs in the middle of the book. And it lists the cast, it lists the guest stars, it gives a page and a half of episode overview, and then she goes into a few more pages of behind the scenes, well, not really behind the scenes stuff, but just sort of what we do with the Deep Geeking.
Sure. Not as good as ours.
Oh, no.
Sure. For one thing, well, we don't have Jeffrey Willith either, so never mind.
Oh. I remember Killick coming to the set, I want to say more than once. I just seem to recall her being around there doing her research really well, and
you probably would see that Fiona Avery was well credited in that book as a thanks, because I think the two of them worked really hard together on making those books as strong and powerful as they could be. I don't know. It's just a little something out there. Better than a cassette story or a bew. So.
Hey, don't knock my cassette story. Man, you guys are rough. All right, here we go. What? Go ahead. Okay, here we
all
go.
All love. No love. Yeah, go.
This is from Katrina in Glenside, Pennsylvania. Are you ready for this one, Summer? And you too, Jeffrey, because you can chime in on this as well. While listening to the Deep Geeking segment during the live feed and hearing Tim obsess over his well-founded beef regarding All Alone in the Night, I found myself wondering what each of you would consider the top five and bottom five for each season of Babylon 5. I think it is safe to say Infection would be squarely at number one of the bottom five in season one for most fans, and that, at least for Tim, All Alone in the Night might rank in the bottom five for season two, but I would be very interested to hear you chime in on this. I myself have a hard time ranking most of the episodes of the series because the show was of a pretty consistent quality, and oftentimes, even the weaker storylines for episodes were bolstered by some pretty intriguing slash important B stories or a very important piece of foreshadowing, a la Sheridan's cosh-induced dream on the Strive ship. As always, thank you for your compelling podcast. I gave it some thought, and I was going to return Katrina an email with my list, but I thought this would be good to share during the show. Now, see, one of the things that coming up with a top five and a bottom five for each season, I think is well nigh impossible for only if you think about especially years three and four, but also season two. As Katrina mentions, the quality is generally high caliber, and really, I can't think of going through season by season and finding the best five and the bottom five. But I can come up with the best five and the bottom five for the entire series.
Yeah, I was gonna when you were reading that, I was thinking I can't do top five and bottom five for each season, even though we do have 22 episodes
no, really,
to choose through.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. That's half the season, so that makes it pretty. I mean, yeah, exactly.
Now I could probably do top two and bottom two for each season. Not off the top of my head, though. But
I was gonna say I've got my list here. I gave it some thought, but I just went through the entire series.
Okay, what's your list of what is it, you said top five and bottom five from
yeah.
all five seasons?
From all five seasons, for the whole series, Babylon 5.
And?
Okay, well, let's start with the top five. And this was actually harder to do than the bottom five. And these are not in any particular, they're not in order. In other words, it's not ranked. Just the five, and actually a runner-up that came to mind. Coming of Shadows, Dust to Dust, The Fall of Night, Severed Dreams, Sleeping in Light. Those are my five. And then runner-up would be The Very Long Night of Londa Mollari.
Okay.
All right. So you're ready for the bottom five?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. Number one, and this is, well, number one, Infection, absolutely. Number two, Gray 17 is Missing. Three would be TKO, Four Eyes, five, A View from the Gallery, and then close runner-up would be, I couldn't decide between Day of the Dead or Grail at that point.
I think a lot of people would disagree with you on some of those choices.
I'm sure they would, but that's, you know. They'll just have to send voicemails and emails. Now, Jeffrey, the question I was going to pose for you, from your end of things, what would be the top five and bottom five, or even top two, bottom two, in terms of producing the episodes? Which ones were just absolutely fantastic to work on, and which ones were just the ones that dragged you through the Looney Tunes machine and strung you out and when it was over, you'd just go, oh my God.
Wow. Okay, that's tricky. And the reason I say that is because you have to remember each episode was 7 days of shooting. And each day, in simplest terms, obviously each day was really two parts. What you shot in the morning, you had your lunch break, what you shot in the afternoon. So that's really 14 completely different focuses per episode. And sometimes some things would just be so cool, even though it only turned out to be a couple of seconds of television. It would take so much time. For example, like in Agropos, which was always kind of stood out to me just because I remember just having so many extras, so many soldiers everywhere and all that sort of stuff. But the fight scene, to choreograph that fight scene I think that was all in the Zocalo area, was like that was a really big deal. A lot of guys going on. And so that was like a standout moment, but does that make it a standout episode in overall production? I don't know. And then so much of the stuff that made this episode so great happened in post, with the CG artists. That gives a great production value. So I don't want to say that's an unfair question, Tim, but damn it, it's an unfair question.
Okay, how about this to try to narrow it down? There were many episodes that had brawls in the Zocalo. Do any of them stand out as being the best coordinated or the worst coordinated in your experience?
I think Gropos was one of the biggest. Oh, and then you guys got to help me with the title. When Lita, when the artifact showed up and everybody was going, thank you, yes, and everybody was going nuts, Obanko. That's right, third, yes. That was quite a scene because it not only involved all our stunt guys, but also had a lot of our main cast in there actually doing stuff. A favorite is seeing Veer trying to choke, was he choking Franklin? So that was a really fun brawl scene. Gropos was definitely a great one. And then there was one particular stunt that always knocked me out, no pun intended. I think that was in Purple. What was it called? Purple, green?
Yeah. Green, purple. Geometry's Shadows.
Yeah.
Thank you. Whatever. Yes. One of the Drazi fights, oh man, I hope that's what it really was. There was a Drazi fight, and I remember this stuntman, I'm sorry I can't remember his name, but he took this running, he was like running through the hall, and a guy stuck his arm out and kind of clotheslined him, and he did a complete flip in the air backwards.
I think I know that one.
Yeah. And I've just never seen a human do that without getting hit by a car. I mean, it was amazing what this guy did. And that was like a super standout moment for me. So, I don't know. Does that answer it?
Fine. That's fine.
All right, mostly it's about interludes and examinations. Best episode. Best episode. Best show. Best everything. Top, middle, bottom. What can I say? But, oh, yeah, okay, I'm biased. Yeah.
Yes, just a little bit.
All right, Summer, you've had 5 minutes. What would you say?
You've got to be kidding me.
Well, come on, you can come up with at least top two, bottom two.
Well, I disagree with your assessment of Eyes and A View from the Gallery. Just saying. Infection's in my bottom two. I don't know. I can't think of a one that I just absolutely could live without?
Coming up with the bottom five was a little easier for me. I guess maybe because I'm just hypercritical or something. Coming up with the top five was much tougher. You know, and really those episodes that I picked for my top five were just ones that, for whatever reason, have, you know, personal meaning above and beyond, you know, their what they meant to the series as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I don't know. I'd have to sit there and actually do some really... Just soul-searching, episode-searching.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. That's your assignment for next week.
Oh, gee, thanks.
And that does it for our email for today. We have been getting listener feedback, and we appreciate everything. It's just that given the voicemail a week off, and they'll come back in full force, I promise you.
Okay. Well, that will do it for this episode of the Babylon Podcast. If you do want to send us an email, that email address is babylonpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to send us your own voicemail, that number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year of the Great War came upon us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the Vorlon.
Boo, 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 boo.